Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this Thanksgiving weekend, we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. Following Black Friday and ahead of what has recently been labeled Cyber Monday, we examine the exodus of consumers from malls and big box stores towards online shopping dominated by Amazon. We will discuss how, by initially outpricing competitors, Amazon has in a short time overtaken and is effectively becoming the market for consumer goods, to the point that they recently had hundreds of cities throughout the United States bend over backwards to become the new Amazon HQ2. And while offering Jeff Bezos billions in taxpayer subsidies, they were handing over invaluable data about American cities, giving Amazon an even greater logistical edge to reign over the new economy and set labor standards across the country. Stacy Mitchell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Costs of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses, joins us to explain how the anti-competitive and anti-democratic tendencies of tech giants have been legitimized and enabled by the recent headquarters sweepstakes. Meanwhile, Amazon continues to capture the retail market while laying the infrastructure for the new economy they will dominate, all the while getting multi-billion dollar contracts from a government that is failing to regulate them. Then, as Americans who still visit malls and brick-and-mortar storefronts are healing their wounds from the stampede of Black Friday shoppers, we speak with the Reverend Billy, an anti-consumerist activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Church of Stop Shopping, a group of post-patriarchal activists who sing while defending neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places, often by staging exorcisms at mega malls and banks, as well as other direct actions that have led to the Reverend Billy being jailed more than 50 times. We discuss the Church of Stop Shopping's protests over the past weekend, highlighting causes from saving Mother Earth to stopping police killings as they interrupt the frenzied bargain shoppers with chants such as, "Hands up, don't shop." And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us on this Thanksgiving weekend is Stacy Mitchell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. And her recent reports include Amazon Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stacy Mitchell.
It's great to be here with you.
Well, thank you. And obviously, people are flocking to the malls, even though malls are closing and big box stores are endangered. Sears has gone bust. Macy's is in trouble. But nevertheless, Walmart seems to be doing okay. But as these Black Friday and these weekend sales go on, we're reminded of the sort of 900-pound gorilla in the room, are we not? Amazon.
That's right. You know, we have seen sales over the Thanksgiving weekend actually decline lately as more and more people shift to shopping at Amazon. I think, you know, Amazon is this sort of rising force that's really reshaping the economy and reshaping it in ways that should very much concern us. It's not just about the decline of big box retailers, you know, who've done a lot of damage themselves. Amazon is sort of a further step in that direction and something that we really need to be taking a much closer look at and really scrutinizing, I think, for its effects on our ability to earn a good living, for its effects on our democracy, and so on.
So it's extraordinary to think that at this moment, when small business has already been suffering for some time because of these big box stalls and these big malls, but now they are suffering because of Amazon, and yet Amazon just recently have been given massive gifts by the mayor of New York and by the neighborhood of Arlington, Virginia. Crystal City is now going to be the site of a new big Amazon facility, along with Long Island City in Queens, New York. And the subsidies are pretty extraordinary. For the Arlington, Virginia subsidy is $573 million. And I think it's, what, about $1.2 billion or something for New York?
If you add up all of the subsidies across both regions, we're actually up over $4.5 billion being handed to Amazon to locate into thriving metro areas that are, you know, exactly where Amazon needed to be. And really, you know, the giveaways are only helping Amazon grow its monopoly power. They're really not at all necessary. And this is a choice that I think was pretty much a foregone conclusion when Amazon started down this whole HQ2 sweepstakes. I think it created this contest in part to gin up those subsidies, to sort of create a bidding war that would put a lot of money on the table. And, you know, the company really has succeeded in hoodwinking cities, and we now see these two regions, as I said, putting $4.5 billion on the table. But I think, you know, what this whole, you know, giveaway to Amazon, it should really compel us to step back and take a deeper look at how it is that we've gotten here. You know, we have a tendency to sort of think about this evolution in the economy, the growing number, you know, the power that a handful of companies have amassed, the loss of small business, the loss of sort of local economies. We tend to think of that as something that's been kind of inevitable. You know, the big companies are more competitive. They, you know, they just came along. It's sort of the natural evolution of the economy. Maybe we're a little, you know, we miss those, we miss having a healthy Main Street and a healthy local job base, but, you know, that's the way things are going because of market forces. But I think when you step back and really look objectively, what you see is that the rise of first Walmart and now Amazon was very much built on public policy. I mean, malls got, you know, going back to the 1950s, malls got these huge tax breaks. They had a huge competitive advantage courtesy of government. Walmart got subsidies on about one out of every three stores that it built. We threw out our antitrust laws at just the moment that Walmart was marching out of Arkansas and becoming a national retail company and using predatory pricing, really, and using its size to undercut the competition, seize the market, and then have a dominant position and leave people with no choice about where to shop. And now we're seeing Amazon use that same playbook in an even more aggressive way. This is a company that's benefited a lot from lax antitrust enforcement and has received a lot of subsidies to date. I mean, most of their warehouses have been built with public subsidies. They've benefited from enormous tax breaks. Last year, Amazon effectively paid no federal taxes at all. And now we've got these two regions putting $4.5 billion in subsidies on the table. I mean, the reason that Amazon dominates the web is because we have used public policy to put our thumb on the scales and ensure that outcome, and we're doing it to our own detriment and to the detriment of a more competitive, diverse economy.
And again, I'm speaking with Stacey Mitchell, who's the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. And her recent reports include Amazon Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. So here you have Amazon getting subsidies worth more than $2 billion on the promise of jobs. And in the case of Crystal City in Arlington, Virginia, there's virtually no unemployment because that's right in the heart of the military-industrial complex area. Enormous amounts of government jobs there. And then where there is unemployment in Washington, D.C., it's if people are in fact going to commute from D.C. to this new Amazon facility, it's just going to make the already impossible traffic jams across the Potomac even worse. So there are lots of factors in there that don't seem to have been thought through. But you have to, in terms of just government subsidies, let alone these subsidies from New York and from Northern Virginia, already Amazon Web Services have a $600 million deal with the Central Intelligence Agency, and they are the front runners bidding for the Department of Defense's $10 billion winner-take-all cloud services contract, which Amazon is most likely to get. So this is pretty amazing, isn't it? This trillion-dollar company gets subsidies from local governments and gets huge contracts from the federal government.
That's right. And it's, you know, I think as citizens, we should really be alarmed. I mean, the reason that we have antitrust law, the reason that we have this long tradition in the United States of being concerned about concentrated economic power is that inevitably concentrated economic power translates into political power. And we see that very much with Amazon. And this is one of the reasons that the company, was almost certain to locate its expansion in the Washington, D.C. metro, is they're, you know, they very much want to have, have influence over government regulators that might look at them in terms of an antitrust case, and they also want to have very close access to all of these rich government contracts. In the case of the winner-take-all defense contract that you mentioned for cloud services, this is an RFP that came out of the government that looks to have been tailor-made for Amazon. You know, and a lot of other companies have been really unable to compete for that because of the specific ways in which that RFP was written to really fit Amazon, and even other companies in the cloud business are saying they can't really bid for this effectively because of the way the RFP was written. Last year we had a situation where as part of an authorization bill that really had to come through, it had to get passed through Congress, there was an amendment put in that bill that was widely referred to around the Hill as the Amazon Amendment. Because what it did is it directed the General Services Administration, which is like the branch of government that oversees the federal government's purchasing of commercial goods. So, you know, everything from like office supplies to lab equipment, like all the stuff that the federal government buys that's just normal, everyday commercial goods. Those purchases are done through the Government Services Administration. And this Amazon amendment directed the GSA to shift its purchasing to a, quote, online e-commerce portal. And, of course, if you read that law, it sounded a lot like shift your purchasing to Amazon. So Amazon is also now in line to become the portal for much of the commercial purchasing that the U.S. government does. And as we documented in a report earlier this year, Amazon is also taking over the procurement of cities, counties, and school districts. More than 1,500 local jurisdictions have signed on to a contract with Amazon that turns over, you know, their spending to this company. So I think, you know, if you step back from this and you look at the subsidies and the tax advantages and the taking hold of procurement, you really see a company that wants to kind of envelop government and reorganize government for its own benefit. And I think that's really dangerous. I mean, it's dangerous if you believe in like the idea of competition and markets and sort of the innovation and dynamism of the American economy, but it's also incredibly dangerous if you believe in democracy and this notion that we need to have openness, transparency, accountability in our government. We're really losing that as we see Amazon take over and extend its tentacles.
Well, this scandalous behavior on the part of cities and states using taxpayer money as corporate bribes, it's pretty transparently corrupt and morally indefensible. And we've seen it for some time where cities have been building free stadiums for billionaire sports franchises. And that's been pretty obvious and rather disgraceful. But now it seems it's gone into a whole. It's ramped up enormously. It's now a $90 billion per year national scam. And as far as I can see, there is little to no evidence that this is the great job creator as it's touted as. So what kind of figures do you have on that, Stacey?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a good academic research done by Nathan Jenkins and others, and really documented the fact that these giveaways, $90 billion, as you note, that local governments spend, generate no net economic benefits. I mean, at best, they're moving jobs from one location to another. That's all that's being achieved here. And because those giveaways, they also skew heavily to the largest companies, which makes sense. You know, you're a big company like Amazon, you have the muscle to go in and extract these giveaways from governments in a way that, you know, your local hardware store does not. So it has the effect of furthering consolidation at the expense of smaller businesses, which has a lot of negative effects on the economy that we have documented. So we're not getting any benefits. We're, in fact, probably doing a lot of harm to just jobs and opportunity for ordinary people and wages through these giveaways. The one silver lining, I think, in this whole HQ2 debacle is that it has prompted calls for a federal bill that would essentially tax companies $1 in tax for every $1 in subsidies that you get. And so it would effectively get rid of these deals. And I'm really hoping that that's something that that lawmakers pick up and run with.
Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Stacey Mitchell on this Thanksgiving weekend, where we're talking about how Amazon has replaced the big box stores along with malls that are closing on this weekend of frenzied shopping.
You know, I've seen a lot of people walking around with tombstones in their eyes. But the pusher don't care. Ah, if you live or if you die. God damn.
So all of the business are unlimited. Tell where they buy and they sell, and they sell all their trash to each other till they're sick of it. Oh, and they're bankrupt on selling. And all of the angels, they sell off your soul for a set of new wings and anything gold they remember.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And on this Thanksgiving weekend, we are continuing the conversation with Stacey Mitchell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. And her recent reports include Amazon Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Businesses. And of course, with people frantically shopping at the malls across the country today, we're looking at how malls are closing and big box stores are endangered because of the growing market power of Amazon. Well, of course, Amazon got some reasonably good publicity recently because they made this announcement of raising the minimum wage. But nevertheless, there are some in the, the fine print, it seems to be being offset by workarounds, subcontracting, cutting stop options for employees, etc. How did that shake out?
I think that's right. You know, Amazon, you know, we have to understand a little bit about the context of Amazon setting this $15 an hour minimum wage. The context is that they needed to hire a lot of seasonal workers over the holidays. They needed to bring on about 100,000 people temporarily, and it's a very tight labor market. And meanwhile, Senator Bernie Sanders, Congressman Ro Khanna, and others were, you know, very much going after Amazon for the fact that a lot of its employees make so little that they rely on food stamps and other forms of public assistance. And, you know, as Ro Khanna and Bernie Sanders were saying, how is it that this wealthy company, you know, has this workforce that is so impoverished that they need public assistance? And that they were getting a lot of traction and a lot of visibility for that message. And so I think Jeff Bezos very astutely looked at this situation that Amazon was in and said, you know, I'm going to have to raise wages anyway to deal with the tight labor market. Let's pick $15 an hour, you know, which is kind of a number that popular, you know, that progressives have really pushed for, labor groups and others. I'm going to pick $15 an hour and be very public about it as a way to buy some goodwill on the left, and in particular to help kind of head off, hopefully, growing concerns about Amazon's market power and growing calls for antitrust investigation of Amazon, which I think Bezos believes is more likely to come from Democrats than Republicans. And so I think this is a way of kind of splitting off and buying off part of those constituents. But as you note, when you look even, you know, more closely at the $15 an hour minimum, Amazon also took away a number of benefits. Longtime workers are reporting that they're actually making less under this shift than they were before. And Amazon's long-range approach to cutting labor costs is actually automation. I mean, they have in the works technology that will begin to supplant humans in their warehouses. Already, they're using far fewer workers than brick-and-mortar retailers need, and so we've seen lots of job losses in the retail sector as Amazon has grown, and of course, Amazon's locating jobs in just a few places. Meanwhile, lots of regions of the country, lots of second-tier cities and small towns, they've only experienced job losses and business losses as a result of this company's growth. So when you look at all of those things together, you know, I think what you see is the picture of a company that's very much part of the story of rising inequality, and that this announcement didn't change that. It was an attempt to really change the politics around Amazon's power more than anything else.
Well, my understanding is that even if these jobs happen, they are happening in, at least in terms of Crystal City and Long Island City, they're happening in places where there's already a tight real estate market. And Seattle, which is Amazon's hometown, they happen to have some of the highest rents in the country, along with Silicon Valley. And they also have, in Seattle, chronic homelessness. So is there a connection there?
That's absolutely true. You know, I think, and it's a very strong connection. You know, what we are seeing is that as corporations consolidate the economy, many industries where, you know, only, you know, a handful of companies now dominate. One of the effects of that is we've seen growing concentration, if you will, geographically. So there are only a handful of metro areas that have actually seen real job growth, wage growth, and business growth in this recovery. Just a few places, mostly on the coast. Meanwhile, lots of second-tier cities, small towns, rural regions, they have all continued to lose ground. You know, they have not seen a recovery. And people are really hurting in those regions. And so what we've seen is this just growing geographic disparity. And even within, as you know, even within the, quote, winning cities like Seattle, they are marked by this stark inequality. You know, the median home value price, selling price now in Seattle is well over $700,000. Meanwhile, you have this homelessness crisis that the city is really struggling to solve. You know, so it's, you know, Amazon is very much part of this narrative. It's really a driving force behind rising inequality. You know, it's the reason that, you know, parts of, you know, Ohio and Maine and other regions of the country are really struggling economically, and is the reason that you have these places where, you know, a handful of people or some portion of the population is doing really well and everybody else is really struggling in a market where, you know, real estate costs are through the roof and it's become totally unaffordable. You know, one of the things that I think is particularly disturbing in looking at the giveaways in Washington and New York, you know, with what's happened in Seattle in mind, is that most of the jobs that are going to be created in these new locations are going to be high-paying tech jobs, and they're going to go, you know, primarily to people who are already doing well, many of them people who relocate to D.C. and relocate to New York to take those Amazon jobs, they're not going to go to local people. And at the same time, we're going to see housing costs escalate. We're going to see growing cost of living in general and increasing pressures on infrastructure, transportation, schools, and so on. So middle-class people, working-class people in those communities are actually going to see their standard of living decline because they're not going to get any of these high-paying jobs, and then they're going to pay a higher cost of living. And that might be, the way that a city should have approached Amazon wanting to locate is not to give it money, but to demand that it make investments to offset those costs. You know, you want to be in a place with good transportation and good schools and lots of housing and so on. You as a company have to be a good corporate citizen and pony up. But instead, we've seen this complete inversion where instead of Amazon making investments, we've got the public making investments in Amazon.
Well, but back to this Amazon much publicized search for new headquarters, where 238 American cities essentially auditioned, and whether or not it was a con from the beginning, I don't know. It looks as if they'd already pretty much made their mind up before they even began, but I guess there's no way of knowing that. But what happened apparently was that all of these cities, in order to apply to become rewarded with these Amazon facilities, they gave up an awful amount, a tremendous amount of data on the cities, on the infrastructure, a lot of valuable market data, which now Amazon is free to use or sell.
That's exactly right. And it's a point that I've been making for a long time, that this whole HQ2 sweepstakes, Amazon got a lot of valuable publicity out of it. It got a lot of value in terms of the subsidies that it's been able to get out of this ultimately. But those things may not be even the most valuable assets that Amazon gained from this whole process. It may very well be the data that cities handed over. Initially 238 cities submitted bids, and then 20 finalists submitted even more information. Cities gathered up, they spent thousands of hours gathering up data and pulling together a lot of information to hand over to Amazon about future land use patterns, real estate trends, other kinds of development, infrastructure in the works. I mean, imagine, knowing future development patterns in a city where things were likely to happen, where investment, you could make a lot of money investing in real estate in the right locations, right? And cities handed over just incredibly valuable data for free to Amazon, data that is not in many cases publicly available and is not available to Amazon's competitors. And I think in the coming years, we're going to see that Amazon is going to make very prodigious use of this data to site warehouses, other kinds of facilities, and also to get an inside view as to what cities might be willing to pony up. Because all these cities, they sort of put their cards on the table about here's what we might offer for subsidies, here's, how much we're willing to open our wallets. Well, knowing that information, now Amazon has a bargaining advantage over these cities as well. And I think this whole year-long process, we've been kind of focused on which city will it go to, and then we've been focused on, well, it's not one city, it's two cities. But the real answer is that Amazon's intention is to go everywhere, that this is really a company that wants to monopolize the economy. And it is going to use every advantage that it's gained through this process to further undermine competition and to further its own market dominance. And, it's incredibly frustrating to me that cities have gone along with this. They've effectively abetted a monopolist at the expense of their own futures and well-being.
Well, just in closing, in our previous conversation a while back, Stacey, you made the point that Amazon is not just capturing the market or dominating the market. Its real intention is to become the market. So just in the last minute or so, could you explain that?
That's right. You know, to think of Amazon as a retailer, I think is really to miss what this company is about. Amazon is an infrastructure company. It now, it's, you know, and there's several pieces to that infrastructure. The most important is the platform. You know, its website has become the first stop for most people when they're looking to buy something online. People no longer go to Google and put something into a search engine. Most people now start their product search right on Amazon. And what that means is every other company that wants to make or sell consumer goods, if they want to reach the market online, they have to go through Amazon. They have to set up as a third-party seller on Amazon's site in order to reach the market. And that means that their biggest competitor now controls their access to the market. Amazon sets the terms for how those companies are able to operate on its platform. It controls search results, whether they show up in the search results. It sets the fees that they have to pay. And because there are no other competing platforms that are viable out there, companies really have no choice but to pay up. In effect, this is not a market. You know, a market is an open place that's governed by public rules. You know, we decide we're going to have, you know, market days on Wednesdays, and everybody gets a stall, and we're going to make sure the scales are fair and all of those kinds of things. That's a democratic public process to establishing a market. But Amazon is moving us to this world where transactions increasingly occur in a private arena that it controls, where it has a godlike view of everything that's going on, has access to all the data about what everybody is doing, everybody else is in the dark, and it gets to pick winners and losers instead of us picking winners and losers. That's a very dangerous situation. You know, back when Franklin Roosevelt very effectively fought monopolies beginning in the 1930s, he would refer to monopolies as a form of dictatorship. And I think we need to really think about that, because that's in effect what Amazon is doing. It's becoming a kind of dictator over the economy because of this ability to control market access. So it's not just, you know, as you noted, it's not just about Amazon dominating this market or that market. It's about Amazon controlling the infrastructure that everybody else needs to rely on. And in a democracy, we can't allow that to happen. Otherwise, we have given up our liberty. We've given up the very notion of a market. And we've given up our rights as citizens to set the terms of how markets operate.
Well, Stacey Mitchell, I thank you so much for joining us on this Thanksgiving weekend.
Thanks. It's been great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stacey Mitchell, who's the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Her most recent reports include Amazon Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the anti-consumer activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Church of Stop Shopping, the Reverend Billy.
Here's the man with teeth like God's shoes, shiny sparkles, shimmers, shines. Let's all have another orange Julius fixer if standing. The malls are the soon to be ghost towns. Well, so long, farewell, goodbye.
Well, I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I got my blessed Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car. Through all trials and tribulations, and
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this Thanksgiving weekend is the Reverend Billy, who is an anti-corporatist activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Church of Stop Shopping, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. He's been jailed more than 50 times and was a central figure in Occupy Wall Street and toured 25 Occupied Wall Street tent communities from Zurich to Oakland, California, with the Stop Shopping Choir, a group of post-patriarchal activists who sing as they create a spiritual community based on justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Reverend Billy.
Hallelujah. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Your Holiness. It's an honor and a privilege to speak to you on this august holiday where many Americans are in a frenzy at the malls. But, of course, our previous guest was talking about how Amazon is taking over the world and the malls are closing and the big box shopping centers are in trouble. But that doesn't mean that you're not busy on this day. And, of course, you were pretty busy on Black Friday, were you not?
Yes, we paraded down Fifth Avenue with a giant banner that said "Tourists against Trump" on one side, and then "Stop Shopping" on the other. And that's high end. That's Rodeo Drive East. So that's high end shopping, and it's still, I don't think it's quite been taken over by Amazon yet, but it's symbolic. It's the flagship stores of these famous, you know, European-sounding shops. So we contacted lots of people. And there are lots of tourists who suddenly drop out of their depoliticized consumer selves, and they say, yeah, Trump's got to go. He's a gangster. So I do believe that there's a revolution in the offing, and that people who are not usually political will become political to save their own lives.
Right.
The stakes are apocalyptic.
Well, but isn't Trump pretty unpopular in his hometown?
Yes. Any Republican is even if you live here, like Nixon, is unpopular in New York. That's true.
Right, but you were just saying he's a gangster. He's hardly a politician. That's just his latest avatar. He might well have been put into office by his buddy Vladimir Putin. So when you say this is an apocalyptic time, Reverend Billy, do you feel as if the law is finally closing in on Donald Trump, who has been one step ahead of the sheriff throughout his entire business career?
You know, I tire of, not to belittle your question, Mr. Masters, but I tire of the guessing about Trump's fate. It's like Zeno's arrow, you know, the mm-hmm. Greek philosopher who postulated that the arrow never gets to the bullseye because you can always divide in two the tip of the arrow and the distance to the canvas of the bullseye. There's always more of him somehow. But for New Yorkers, he was our kind of class clown for so long. We were as taken by surprise as anybody else by what's happened. The thing that will catch up to him is the Earth. The life systems of the Earth are changing radically to navigate human beings, especially upper middle class and ruling class Americans who consume too much. I'm thinking that his calling the California fires forced mismanagement and belittling the Puerto Rican hurricane, if something, I don't, can't quite say how it's going to happen because the Earth is a mystical being, but that is what will get him. He will be caught and turned back into a forest floor.
Well, your criticism is well taken because I feel in many ways complicit just covering Trump's antics because it is government by stunt. And the whole purpose of his governance is to distract us from the wholesale theft of the United States by him and his cronies.
Right.
So it is a bit of a trap, and it's hard to navigate. And needless to say, it's demoralizing just having to dole out the daily dose of doom covering this man. But we have got to find a way to get ahead of this. We can't allow such an appalling con man, a low-life, bottom-feeding joke to dominate our lives and ruin our planet.
You're very articulate, Mr. Masters. No, I think the Earth is rising up. All the Earth cultures say they all have that prophecy. I heard it at Zuccotti Park from a woman named Candy Moffat, whose Lakota name is more like Eagle Woman, and she was standing on a bench. She was saying that the old prophecy has it that the Earth will rise up to cleanse, to balance, to reinvent, to survive, and that the human beings may or may not be invited along. There will be possibly a window of opportunity to survive with the Earth, but if you don't respond to the call, you'll disappear. And we may already have missed our opportunity, but I think that if you just spend a little bit of time, not necessarily with the media, but look back at what is going on from the vantage point of our Earth, then things look much different. It becomes easier to be a radical among people. You have another kind of courage that is informed with spirituality. You have another kind of courage that's beyond ego, beyond even political theory. You can go from door to door. You can be fearless because fear is no longer a question. It's about survival. It's about connection. It's about making communities. More and more over the years, and I've been a political person now for decades, more and more over the years I see life itself as a political force. Earthalooyah?
And again,
what kind of preaching is this? Give me a pulpit.
Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord. Well, no. We're post-patriarchal.
Okay.
Praise
the lady.
Well, Mother Earth.
Mother Earth.
In here.
Gaia. There you go. So, Your Grace, tell me, you have been doing these Thanksgiving protests for some time. I recall when we last spoke when you were holding a Thanksgiving feast in front of Monsanto's headquarters. And it looks as though actually Monsanto has been pulled over. They've had to admit that Roundup is a poison that may be destroying the bee population, among other things. So tell us about that action.
Well, we had an organic meal in front of the Monsanto headquarters in St. Louis, Missouri. And we were there for a while, and we just thought, well, Jesus Christ, you know, Ferguson is about 6 miles away, and this is right at the time of Black Lives Matter, and so many of the people in the choir are not European. We went over there, and we ended up in the middle of the night in a Walmart with about a couple hundred African-American teenagers from Ferguson, and we were all shouting, "Hands up! Don't shop! Hands up! Don't shop! Hands up! Don't shop!" So we had the integration of two issues. I mean, the integration of the issues always existed. The integration that had to take place was our own perspective, that we would think that being against consumerism and being for harmony among the races, racial justice, we would think that they're different issues. So, you know, for months and months before that, the entire world was taught to shout, "Hands up, don't shoot," a kind of mockery of the police when you're marching by them. But they converted it that weekend. Thanksgiving weekend, they were boycotting big businesses in Ferguson, Missouri. They changed the "hands up, don't shop." And ultimately, all the issues are one issue. I think I learned something that weekend. The issue is life itself. When we draw our last breath, then we will realize, oh, there is only one issue. And in surviving right now, there is justice. All our campaigns are together in that moment. And we badly need to unite our issues, because leftist progressive people are famous for splintering into 60 different subjects. And then this time of year especially, here it is, everybody's asking for money now. We start competing with each other for the same dollar. That exists all year long, because people, like the classic example is the environmental movement, the Sierra Club, the Environmental Defense Fund, and so forth. They're like castles. They have moats around them, and they have their own money-making ventures, and they, you know, they're in competition with each other, and I think that's one of the reasons they've been so powerless to do anything about climate change and the extinction species spiral that we're in, is they're in competition with each other. We all have to gather now together. It's something to remember here at Thanksgiving, or as the Native Americans call it, Thanks-taking, here at the harvest, the grateful part of the year. It's time to unite. It's time to gather together. And then suddenly gangsters like Donald Trump will be very isolated. Lovelulia.
Earthalulia. And of course, it's always been an extraordinary irony that it was the Native Americans who saved the pilgrims by feeding them, which became the basis of the Thanksgiving celebration. But the one thing about Thanksgiving, albeit tempered by the fact that here we are talking on the shopping weekend, starting with Black Friday on Friday through this weekend, where people are out, you know, bumping into each other and climbing over each other to get $10 off something that's made in Taiwan or China or Burma or Vietnam or Bangladesh.
Sweatshops, yeah.
Sweatshops. But you mentioned earlier at Zuccotti Park, I think you said it was a Dakota Sioux woman, and you just mentioned a minute ago, the Reverend Billy, the idea of Thanksgiving to the Native Americans is thanks-taking. I'm always astounded at the incredible stoicism of Native Americans. And just in this last election cycle, the idea that the state legislature in North Dakota changed the rules at the last minute so that the Native American vote would be suppressed by taking away post office boxes, which most people living on reservations used. It's an amazing, disgraceful tradition of screwing the Native Americans. When is it going to stop?
Well, that, you know, I also think of Stacey Abrams in Georgia, the person who's in charge of the electoral system there is her opponent, you know, Brian Kemp. And he starts pulling votes out of the system because he says they are somehow imperfect. So, yes, we have in the gerrymandering, of course, which both parties are guilty of, but especially the Republicans. So that is all, that's all consumerism. That's all shopping. You know, that's commodifying our votes. Because they make so much money. The Republicans are so wealthy because of how they have purchased the political system. Of course, the Democrats, too. I mean, the Clintons. How did they get there? $250 million. You know, selling books? I don't think so. So the commercial politics needs to be overwhelmed, and I'm glad that that process, if it wasn't a blue wave, at least something started where some new people got in there. Our neighbor from the Bronx up here, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, really leading the way. So there's some ground for hope, but the we have to move beyond hope right now. The level of emergency is not understood in a consumer society because we're immersed in products, and they make us slow down. They distract us. They're like all the products on the shelves are like little Donald Trumps. They're just distracting us, and we're not getting down to the thing that is really facing us, which is premature death as a result of ignoring nature. ignoring the natural world. We have to look at what we do every 5 or 10 or 15 minutes and say, that's not what I'm going to continue to do. We have to break up our schedules. We have to be radical with ourselves in order to be radical on the meta scale, which is necessary, dealing with nation states and big corporations. We have to be radical with ourselves. And right now, we're just continuing to have our end-of-the-world yah-yahs taken care of by these blockbuster films, which are often about, basically, thinly disguised climate change. You know, that we get our blockbuster purge and, you know, take that roller coaster ride through the fire and flood, and then after 90 minutes, we stumble out onto the sidewalk, and we're depoliticized. We can't do anything really about the apocalypse that is in our lives. So, you know, consumerism is no longer just bad. It's deadly. We have to completely shift our attitude about it. There'll come a time when we're just doing citizens' arrests of, you know, Amazon executives. We're just going to start saving our lives. That we're coming to a point where things will be much different. I think that these hurricanes and the fires in California, I think it's starting to dawn on people that we're in a new era. Everything's going to be different. Everything's going to be different. New communities are going to spring up that are built by people who reach out to each other and make new agreements, and they will immediately be called illegal. And they'll go and live somewhere, and they'll immediately be called trespassers. That is what is about to happen. It could happen just it could be happening now. I'm in downtown Brooklyn, New York. I don't pretend to know, you know, what is happening. I'm not everywhere. My surveillance is mostly around my 8-year-old that I have to raise. But I'm convinced that on this Thanksgiving weekend, we need to be grateful for the future if it lets us survive. We have to readjust what we're connecting with out there.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the Reverend Billy, in terms of consumerism changing, it does seem that the millennials are definitely affecting consumerism. For example, a lot of companies, I mean, dreadful restaurants, but popular restaurants like Buffalo Wild Wings, Ruby Tuesday, Applebee's, they're going out of business because millennials are cooking at home. Millennials no longer get married in banquet halls with hotel receptions. They have venues such as barns and farms, etc. They no longer drink beer. The beer companies are suffering. For some reason or other, millennials have killed off mayonnaise. they're also affecting the razor business. Men's razors aren't selling as they used to. Fertility is at a record low. I could go through a whole list of golf is not happening with millennials. and breakfast cereals are no longer happening. They're apparently having yogurt. So is there anything that can be done at the consumer level? I mean, I've actually stopped people in supermarkets buying brawny towels, paper towels, and basically said, you know, buy Bounty. Because Brawny is owned by the Koch brothers.
You have stopped them?
Yeah, I said, well, as I say, you know, you're contributing money to the Koch brothers by buying Brawny.
You get them
Brawny
into an argument?
Well, they usually look at me like I'm mad. But, I mean, what do you think consumer boycotts are a useful political tool?
No, I don't. Although what you're saying is very interesting to me. No, ethical shopping, that's maybe 30 years ago that might have made a difference, but we're way past ethical shopping. We have to change energy, transportation, food systems. We are in a time that demands a radical response, not a gradualist response. It doesn't matter so much that they've shifted from Kellogg's cornflakes to, you know, some kind of super organic granola. That doesn't matter so much. No, we've got our change, it needs to be more severe. We need to end fossil fuel involvement immediately, in all its forms. And fossil fuel just goes through our lives, all the plastics and all the all the shapes around us. We're not even aware of the amount of. So it's a spiritual thing. It's not a theory. It's not saying this will work and that won't work. I'm not really. It's being naked and flying through the sky. It's a different thing. We've got to do a much different thing, and we've all got to break through that madness that you when the people looked at you in the mall and in the grocery store and thought you were crazy for objecting to that purchase. We have to climb up on the exalted sacred altar of total embarrassment at this point. We've got to break through embarrassment. Embarrassment will be in the past. We won't even remember what that was. That's how radical we've got to be. We've got to be so radical that the word change will be forgotten. We won't be trying to change anymore. We'll be out there being radically different. That's what the Earth is expecting us to do. The Earth is, you know, our lives are based on evolution. We've been able to, like, stop it and change it because of modern life, but we have to go back. The Earth is now in charge, and the Earth wants a dynamic change, a big, sudden, all of a sudden change. And we will do it, I think. Some of us will. Some of us will. I mean, the Koch brothers will cling to their refineries, and they'll die there. But some of us will manage to go forward with a much different Earth than we can imagine right now.
Well, indeed. And just in closing, though, there's some hope from the end of work as robotics take over and as millions and millions and millions of people don't have traditional work. I think there's a great opportunity for revival of craftsmanship and people's nurturing and discovering and nurturing their own talents. And, you know, there's talk about a universal basic income, etc. But it's possible that we could have a very creative future if we just reinvent work.
Well, it's a very, very interesting subject. As long as those robots are veggie-powered.
Well, it's something to think about. I know I'm springing it on you at the last minute, but I was sort of casting about for some hope here as our endangered planet reels from our abuse to Mother Earth. And on this Thanksgiving, again, Earthalleluia to you, Reverend Billy.
Well, in my work, this is the time of year when I convert the activism and my group, the 40 people in this singing activist group, the Stop Shopping Choir, we shift our activism. We've been arrested 9 times this year, mostly because some of us are being deported from the choir. We convert that to songs and to rituals in performance. And so, Plug-a-Looia, I'll just tell people that we will be at Joe's Pub at the Public Theater in downtown Manhattan, Sundays through December 23rd, up to Christmas.
From today till Christmas.
Welcome to join us. Amen.
Well, I would love to, and I thank you very much for joining us on this Thanksgiving Sunday, Reverend Billy.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays, everybody.
Earthalleluia to you. And again, I've been speaking with the Reverend Billy, who's an anti-corporatist activist who, in the role of a revivalist minister, leads the Church of Stop Shopping, a group of activists who defend neighborhood economies and freedom of expression in public places. He's been jailed more than 50 times and was a central figure in Occupy Wall Street and toured with 25 Occupied Wall Street tent communities from Zurich to Oakland, California, with the Stop Shopping Choir, a group of post-patriarchal activists who sing as they create a spiritual community based on justice. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.